I have a moral imperative here, and that's to save lives, and if that means giving them a few hundred dollars for an airline ticket to go where they want to go, I'm going to do that.
Mayor Dave Bronson aims to fly homeless Anchorage residents to other communities. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 25th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, federal funding meant to combat climate change may not be enough to relocate eroding communities.
When they see things wash away that connects them to their ancestry, it's devastating.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson says he doesn't foresee the Sullivan Arena becoming a mass homeless shelter again this winter. Instead, he says his administration is working on a proposal to buy homeless residents one-way plane tickets out of the city. Bronson announced the proposal in an interview with the Anchorage Daily News yesterday and discussed it at a news conference this morning. He says people could opt to fly to a warmer location or somewhere where they have loved ones.
It's not difficult to administer. Someone says, I want to go to Los Angeles or San Diego or Seattle or Kansas. It's not our business. My job is to make sure they don't die on Anchorage streets.
City officials estimate there are currently roughly 750 homeless people in Anchorage. The mayor says the city set a record for outdoor deaths among homeless people last winter, and he's concerned it'll be worse this year, especially without a mass shelter.
This winter, we're looking at possibly even doubling that. So I have a moral imperative here, and that's to save lives, and if that means giving them a few hundred dollars for an airline ticket to go where they want to go, I'm going to do that.
Assembly Chair Chris Constant said in an interview today that the Assembly hasn't been briefed on the mayor's plan. He says he has questions, including how much it would cost. He also says a majority of homeless people in Anchorage are from Anchorage.
I just don't think there are that many people who are from faraway places that we would be returning them home. And so it just, practically speaking, again, it raises just so many questions.
Bronson says he doesn't have a funding source for the proposal yet. Constant and Bronson both agree that Anchorage has had little help from the state to address its growing homelessness crisis, but they will continue to seek funding from the legislature and governor. While Anchorage has 40% of the state's population, it also has roughly two-thirds of the state's homeless population. Meanwhile, thousands of lightning strikes around the eastern interior sparked new wildfires Monday. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Two of the fires ignited by lightning Monday are burning in areas off the Pogo Gold Mine Access Road north of Delta Junction. State Division of Forestry and Fire Protection spokesperson Lily Coyle says the biggest is the 150-acre Pogo Mine Road fire that was started by several strikes.
That was actually a cluster of ignition, so there's multiple different starts, and they're very close to each other that we're just considering one fire.
Coyle says the other area fire start, the 6 Mile Pogo Road fire, had burned about 6 acres as of Monday night.
There are no structures threatened on the Pogo Mine Road fire or the 6 Mile Pogo fire. We did have air resources responding and are continuing to monitor.
Further north, the McCoy Creek fire near Salcha had burned about 50 acres as of Monday night, and the Bureau of Land Management Alaska Fire Service was also busy with new lightning starts.
We got a lot of reports coming into the dispatch centers, so we sent some AFS personnel up on a plane to check them out, and as we were sending people out, they were finding new fires.
Alaska Fire Service spokesperson Beth Ipson says the agency recorded 7,000 lightning strikes around the interior. But as of Monday night, the only high-priority fire in the federal agency's area of responsibility was the 5-acre Moose Fire burning near milepost 100 of the Elliott Highway.
It's not immediately threatening anything, but we'd like to keep it from impacting the highway.
Ipson said late afternoon rainfall and the damp subsurface soil around the region should slow the fire's growth.
Those deeper ground layers haven't dried out like they would in a typical year. So most of what we're going to see right now is more surface burning. so they will be a little bit more manageable if we get on them right away.
Meanwhile, rain showers are helping clear the air of smoke that's been drifting into the interior from large wildfires in the Yukon and Northwest Territories.
Definitely rain can help alleviate some of the smoke.
National Weather Service meteorologist Bobby Bianco says that's what happened Monday afternoon in Fairbanks.
And it did reduce some of the smoke here just a little bit. The wind kind of pushed it south of the area, and we see a little bit bluer skies.
The State Department of Environmental Conservation issued an air quality advisory Monday afternoon, stating the smoke poses a potential health threat to vulnerable populations like the elderly, children, and people suffering from heart and lung problems. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
The Biden administration has carved out $120 million for tribal communities across the nation to adapt to climate change. It's part of $440 million set aside for tribes from the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act and other federal spending. The administration says it's the largest amount of climate change funding for tribes in the history of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, but as KNBA's Rhonda McBride found out, that money won't go far in Alaska.
As director of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium's Climate Change Initiative, Jackie Schaefer travels to communities on the front lines of climate change.
New funding coming out is great. Any drop of funding that we have the ability to access is good. But.
And in that word, but, there's a lot to unpack. Schaefer says this latest round of funding won't even cover half of what it'll take to move Kivalina, a community in the Northwest Arctic that's on the edge of being devoured by the ocean. Another problem, the federal grant is competitive, which means that drop of funding will disappear into a huge bucket to be shared with tribes across the country. Schaefer says the communities which face the biggest threat should have top priority. In a statement, the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs, Brian Newland, calls it a historic investment that gives tribes the resources they need to develop and implement protective strategies for their communities. Newland says tribes should look at this first $120 million as a down payment for more help once the needs are identified and prioritized. He said that this funding builds on the work that the Biden-Harris administration is doing across Alaska and Indian Country, including $25 million that went to Nutak and Napakiak for relocation costs. Schaefer says this is good to hear, but believes the federal government has yet to grasp the true cost of climate change for communities like Kivalina.
Even a water system, an average water system, is $70 to $100 million for a community that size. So when you look at that, then you start adding those costs. It really is. It's expensive to build a whole new community.
Schaefer says most of the homes in harm's way are old and in poor condition.
Most of the housing, I would say 80% of the housing in our rural communities cannot be picked up and moved. This is something else that you have to look at.
Rick Toman, one of Alaska's top climate experts, says Alaska has another very pricey problem that other states don't have, melting permafrost.
In 80 years, when people are looking back, the thawing permafrost is going to be one of the big ticket items that we will have had to deal with as Alaskans.
Toman says the planning for Alaska will be difficult and costly because with permafrost, there are so many unknowns.
We don't know the fine details. We don't know which stretches of roads will newly start to collapse under thawing permafrost, but we know it's going to happen somewhere, and it's going to happen most places over the coming decades.
Jackie Schaefer deals with these unknowns every day in her job with the Tribal Health Consortium, but this is what she does know as she visits communities like Kivalina, an island once 8 miles long, now reduced to a mile.
Our people, because they're so connected to the land, air, and sea, when they see things wash away that connects them to their ancestry, it's devastating.
Realities, Schaefer says, that are hard to truly grasp in both cost and magnitude unless they're at your doorstep. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, generations of fishing families struggle to cope with the price of Bristol-based sockeye.
The last thing you want is your children to get strapped to hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt and then have the rug pulled out from under them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
What gives you strength? Strength comes from teaching the Alaskan way of life, getting wood, fishing, hunting, helping people in the community, and being an example for the next generation. If you have forgotten your strength, remember, there's hope, there's joy, there's love, there's peace everywhere. Share what gives you strength at recoveralaska.org/share your strength. This message sponsored by Recover Alaska.
Repairs to a damaged fiber optic cable affecting internet and cellular services to much of Western Alaska will now take longer than initially anticipated, according to Alaska-based communications company Quintillion. That's because repairs to the cable can't happen until sea ice opens up enough for a vessel to get through. Quintillion plans to begin repair operations in the first weeks of August if the area is 90% free of ice. In a statement published July 14th, Quintillion said a repair vessel would be in the North Slope community of Wainwright by the middle of August on standby for when the ice opened up. Michael McHale is the president of Quintillion.
It looks like right now the ice is cooperating with us and moving as expected, in some cases even faster than expected. So, you know, we'll expect the repair ship to be on standby outside of Wainwright. And as soon as it can access the area, we'll go in and start to effect the repair.
McHale says the ice will likely open the first and second weeks of August, with repairs expected to take up to a week. In early June, the company announced the subsea outage was a result of an ice scouring event. Quintillion initially estimated the break could result in a 6 to 8 week outage. It's now been 6 weeks, and repairs are still stalled by sea ice, leaving some customers questioning whether repairs will be made before freeze-up. Some residents have opted to order Starlink, a satellite internet provider. McHale says that the cable break in early June was the first outage since the subsea cable went live in December 2017, and that the company is working to improve how the cable is buried. Meanwhile, a state judge has ordered a tourist shop outside Denali National Park to stop selling products labeled as Made in Alaska after the state of Alaska accused the shop of repeatedly selling fake souvenirs and art. The Alaska Beacon reports that, according to a complaint filed by the Alaska Department of Law on Thursday in Fairbanks, the owners of a shop known variously as the Himalayan and Mount McKinley Clothing Company repeatedly attempt to mislabel foreign products as Alaska-made and represented themselves as a Yakutat Village Council nonprofit. At one point, the owners of the store told an undercover investigator, quote, that an alpaca poncho depicting a Native American chief in a feather headdress reflected Alaska traditions, end quote. Alaska has no native alpacas, and the Yakutat Village Council does not exist. In response to the complaint, Superior Court Judge Patricia Haynes issued a restraining order and preliminary injunction against the Himalayan and its owners on Monday. The order requires that the store not sell products labeled as made in Alaska or made by an Alaska native unless those products are approved by the state. As the state's tourism industry rebounds after the COVID-19 pandemic emergency, state and federal officials have been cracking down on fake Alaska native art. Passing off a foreign-made souvenir as Alaska-made is a violation of state law, and if a store falsely claims that an item was made by an Alaska native or a member of a native tribe, it may be a federal crime as well. The state office that manages food stamps has been making progress working through a backlog, delaying the benefits for thousands of Alaskans, but new problems have cropped up. Most recently, advocates say the appeals process for denied or delayed applications is failing. Those advocates at the Alaska Legal Services Corporation are helping would-be food stamp beneficiaries in court hearings, and they say the state is still taking an unlawfully long time to approve applications. The state had blamed the backlog on a cyber attack and a deluge of applications at the end of the official public health emergency for the COVID pandemic, but anonymous state workers told then-KTOO reporter Claire Strempel that budget cuts and understaffing had caused long waits for Alaskans desperate for food. Strempel works for the Alaska Beacon now and is here to talk about her continued reporting on food stamp issues in Alaska. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Wesley.
So can you walk us through this legal action over the backlog of food stamp benefits?
Yeah, that started early this year. So in January, a group of 10 Alaskans sued the Department of Health because they'd been waiting too long for food stamps. So food stamps are also known as SNAP. It's a federal program the state manages, but it has to manage it within certain parameters, like getting people's paperwork done and their benefits to them within 30 days. And the state's Department of Health wasn't working anywhere near fast enough, hence the lawsuit. So as a result, in May, the state promised to cut its backlog in half within 6 months if the plaintiffs would agree to put the lawsuit on hold. And if they failed, then the lawsuit could continue. And the great news is the state seems to have done that. The new director of the Division of Public Assistance, Deb Etheridge, she manages the group that manages food stamps. She's been working with staff to get through that backlog, which it turns out was huge. Federal numbers show the state was behind on as many as 19,000 applications. And they seem to have worked through the bulk of the backlog and all of the recertifications.
So it sounds like the state, after these lawsuits, realized how big of an issue the food stamps benefit was and kind of the scope of it.
Yeah, so it's sometimes hard to tease out numbers because the state reports its status in a like a yearly format, which means it's kind of hard to track improvement or when things aren't going well. And so they broke out month-to-month figures on their processing times for benefits. And it shows that they've really turned things around, but that things were also really bad. So at the height of the backlog, the state's Division of Public Assistance was processing less than 10% of applications on time. So that's from December of 2022 to April of 2023, less than 10% of applications were getting processed in the lawful time frame. So for 4 months, 90% of Alaskans who tried to get recertified for food benefits were waiting more than a month.
And it sounds like there's also legal help from the Legal Services Corporation. Can you describe that work?
What's really interesting about this is it's not just attorneys from Alaska Legal Services, but also a bunch of volunteers. And they helped nearly 2,000 people get fair hearings, which are basically an appeal to the state that says, hey, you're late, that's illegal, please file my benefits. And so the state does. And that helped people get their money for food, which is huge because some families had been waiting for 4 or 5 months. One family that I talked about with a legal volunteer, the family was waiting several months, and they ended up getting nearly $20,000 that the state owed them for food.
Wow. And I understand that now the appeals are what is an issue, sort of getting benefits. Can you walk through those issues with appeals and delays in them?
So those fair hearings appeals that we were just talking about, they're happening because there are still delays in getting benefits while the state is getting back on track. But they're short staffing in the group of people that gets the appeals from the Department of Health to the Department of Administration that schedules them. It's a little complicated, but the point is that Alaska Legal Services is really worried because they're anticipating a lot more of these appeals for another reason. Nationwide, states need to check their Medicaid rolls to make sure everyone getting benefits still qualifies for them. And that's because during the pandemic, no one lost benefits. They were on hold to make sure everyone had care. But now that same department that's struggling to get out of a backlog on food stamps has a bunch more paperwork to do for another kind of benefits. And those advocates are worried that we could see another backlog, but this time for Medicaid.
Well, it sounds like some people are starting to get their benefits. You mentioned the family that got $20,000 in benefits from the state. But even if they're getting it now, retroactively, I imagine a lot of damage has already been done.
Yeah. What I've been hearing from people who have gotten their benefits after an extended period is that, number one, they're really grateful. They're relieved and happy. And number two, they're still kind of worried because of all the emergency things that they had to do to keep feeding their families, which really took a toll. People fell behind on rent, and a lot of people racked up credit card debt, something I heard a lot about, and that comes with interest. And back benefits don't come with interest. And so people are still going to be paying that back and dealing with those consequences for a long time.
Well, Claire Strempel is a reporter with the Alaska Beacon following the state's issues with SNAP benefits. Claire, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks, Wesley.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's waters and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help stop aquatic hitchhikers by remembering to clean boots, boats, and trailer to remove plants, animals, and mud. drain bilge, ballast, and buckets before leaving the area, and dry equipment before using it in a new body of water. Learn more at stopaquatichitchhikers.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Sustaining membership offers public media greater financial stability month to month, so consider making a sustaining gift to this station. Thank you.
5 days after fishermen in Bristol Bay protested the record low price for sockeye salmon, processors still haven't budged. Many fishermen are considering selling their permits and boats, but for young members of the fleet, the decision on whether to return next year is especially difficult. KDLG's Jack Darrell reports.
Wesley Blau and Jordan Maynor are childhood friends, growing up crewing on their father's boats in Bristol Bay. Now in their mid-20s, they live in Hoonah, Alaska, and Bainbridge Island, respectively. But they return each season to deckhand. Blau says it's like a family reunion.
This is the only time we see each other, but you build friendships and everything, and the camaraderie amongst fishermen every summer, because we're all technically have our own business with our own boat, but we're all in this together.
4 weeks into the fishing season, processors posted a record low base price of 50 cents per pound, less than half of last year's price, igniting outrage and frustration among crews across the fishery. Their fathers, Darren Maynor and Shane Blau, helped organize the protest in the Naknek River, where over 100 boats anchored up in a demonstration, calling on processors to increase the base price and transparency in the fishery. Blau, Maynor, and their fathers have been through many fishing seasons, but this is their first protest together. And Maynor says it might be his last year commercial fishing.
And frankly, it scared me away from fishing. I would have loved to be involved in this. My dad's been doing this for a long time, and I wish I could have gotten involved, but there's just no way you can make that risk for a family or build up anything when you just don't know what you're making.
Wesley's father, Shane Blau, says it's the lowest price he's seen in his 35 years of fishing.
It's been hard. It's been tears.
Blau says as costs and uncertainty increase each season, he's discouraging his children from following in his footsteps. And as a lifelong fisherman, it's heartbreaking.
But the last thing you want is your children to get strapped to hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt and then have the rug pulled out from under them. And that's what's going on. I didn't think it would happen quite this way, quite this fast, but it has. And thank goodness that, you know, I've given my kids that advice, and right now they see it clear-eyed.
Blau's son Wesley says he's been considering investing in a boat and the fishery for the last 6 years. But with this season's price news, he's listening to his father and making other plans.
My whole entire life, that's all I've ever wanted to do is buy a boat and get into fishing. But anymore, I'm thinking there's no point in coming out here, getting in all this debt, and then just hoping they're going to pay us a little something. I can't afford to do that.
Denali Hodgson is a young commercial fisher. They spoke to KDLG while preparing fish for the winter. They're Athabascan and Sugpiak and grew up in South Naknek, set netting with their family. For local residents, fishing is their livelihood. They emphasize this low price will impact Alaska Native communities in Bristol Bay the hardest, where cost of living can be 3, even 4 times higher. Hodgson says that these fish prices hurt everyone, but there are many ways that costs and significant debt can pile up on young fishers, especially as more expensive boats can fish longer and outcompete smaller operations.
And it's not right. It's like pull yourself up from your bootstraps and invest in what you can. But again, not everybody is starting at the same place.
For all the young fishers in Bristol Bay, there's anger and frustration and hurt, but also laughter and reminiscing. Fishers talk about what the fishery means to them and why it's worth fighting for. In Naknek, I'm Jack Darrell.
When Americans walk into a multi-story building, they usually say they're on the first floor. But that's not the case in Alaska's state capital. KTOO's Katie Anastas found out why for this installment of Curious Juno.
Capital tour guide Kirk Smith gets this question all the time.
This building is sort of interesting in the way the floors are labeled. It has a very European feel to it. Right now, you are not on the first floor. You are on the ground floor.
Smith pointed out Art Deco details in the main entrance of the building.
I also like to refer to the architectural style that's in use here as early 20th century American post office.
The Capitol was built in 1931. That was before statehood, so it originally served as a federal and territorial building. A post office was on the second story.
But you notice that the streets on either side of us are very steep, so there is an entrance to the first floor in that back corner, and that was the entrance into the post office.
Juneau's steep streets made it possible to put the post office's entrance on the street level. So the architects called that the first floor and called the one below it the ground floor. The doorway is still there today on Seward Street, about halfway up the block between 4th and 5th. But the post office is long gone. When Alaska became a state in 1959 and the building became the capital, the post office and other federal agencies moved to the Juneau Federal Building.
There's nothing of it left. You know, it would be nice if there was like an antique post office box or a teller window or something, but there's really nothing there. You can actually go in and out through that door, and it just looks like a hallway. So it's too bad.
Architect Wayne Jensen did find one remnant of the old post office. A few years ago, he oversaw seismic upgrades to the Capitol building.
When we did the demolition, we found a door that was kind of closed into one of the walls. I don't remember if it said post office on it, but that was the one thing we did find.
Jensen says putting the post office on the first floor makes sense.
The ground floor isn't as large as the other floors because it goes back into the mountain, back into the hill, and so it's truncated a little bit. And plus it has the boiler rooms and all those things that are more, you know, they're not really occupiable spaces.
According to the building's original floor plans, the door to Seward Street was an employee entrance, and the one on 5th Street was the public entrance. The post office lobby and workroom took up the entire east wing of the first floor.
I know stories, you know, people who lived here in the 50s, 60s, they would go there, you know, every day to get their mail, and it became a social area where you'd walk into the lobby and, you know, get your mail.
Over the years, Juneau residents have worked to keep the Capitol here. In fact, they made the construction in 1931 possible. Congress didn't allocate enough money to buy the whole block where the building stands today, so Juneau residents raised the rest of it.
And that was something that the community put together. Said, well, if the feds can't do it, we'll do it ourselves.
The post office may be a nearly forgotten piece of the building's history, but it's why today's visitors still need to pay extra attention to which floor they're on inside the Capitol. In Juneau, I'm Katie Anastas.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Ava White in Nome, Jack Darrell in Naknek, and Katie Anastas in Juneau. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer tonight is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.